All right, sir, thank you. What a delight and a joy it is to be here and to be with you today and to talk to you about ministry in Appalachia. You will see one of the slides there will give you a pronunciation guide, and I will honor that today by pronouncing it so many different ways. One of them will have to be right before the day is over. If you're from Virginia, you pronounce it one way. If you're from Kentucky, you pronounce it another way. And if you're from West Virginia, you pronounce it the correct way. And so that's just kind of the way it happens. But I am a product of Appalachia. I grew up in the coal fields. My great-grandfather was a Methodist preacher and helped to start what's known today as my home chapel, United Methodist Church. At one point in his ministry, he became convicted about the doctrine of eternal security. And so he got on a train and wrote to Charleston, West Virginia to meet with a group of Baptists about becoming a Baptist minister. And my grandfather, his son, had just returned home from the First World War and just felt that his dad's life had been a little bit too boring. And so when he prepared his dad's socks to go, he put a little soot instead of powder in them. And my grandfather said, my dad went and met with the Baptists at Mount Olive Baptist Church, and he returned home never to discuss the doctrine again and never become a Baptist. So my early roots go deep into Appalachia, deep into the coal fields. I left there in 1969 and headed off to Chattanooga to go to school. Did not have a clue what a Southern Baptist was. My dad was a coal camp pastor. That meant that he pastored churches in coal camps, and those churches were developed along the lines of whoever got there first. Some of them looked like Methodist, some like Presbyterian, some like Baptist, some like Church of God, and some only God knows what they came out of. That's kind of the type of church my dad pastored. It was those annual recall churches. It's kind of like getting your tires retreaded every year. They voted on you every year, and you changed churches every year because you done run out of your 104 sermons, and it was time to go to a new church. And so that's just kind of the life in the mountains. And by the way, that goes on in Southern Baptist life. I was down in southwestern Virginia the other day. An elderly gentleman up in his 80s came up to me, and he said, I'm going to retire after this year. I said, for real? He said, yes. Said, I've now pastored every church in this association, and I can retire. So he had served on a lot of annual recalls. It is good to be here to talk about ministry in Appalachia. I appreciate Dr. Payne asking me to come. If he'd come, I want to give him something here. A couple of things is just thank yous, but also you'll hear me talking about values today. And this is a book put together by an individual from Eastern Kentucky out of Berea College that is probably one of the best definitive books of Appalachia that you can get. And I want to give that book to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And then I'm going to talk about literacy today. And we have a Bible that we're using in the mountains that's been well accepted even among the King James only people. And it's written to where a person with a PhD can appreciate it, but it's also written to where a person with a third grade reading level can understand it. And so we've been promoting this Bible. This was initiated by a fellow out in Texas who's now gone home to be with the Lord named W.A. Criswell, who recognized that we have a literacy issue in America today and wanted a Bible that people could read. So I want to give this to you,
thank you,
brother.
Sir.
Thank you.
I appreciate that very much.
I have a tendency to ignore time, and Mike, who is here from West Virginia, would tell you that probably I can't tell time, but if I go past about 10 till, I need somebody here to just wave at me, okay? I'm not offended by that, but I do need somebody to let me know because I do have a tendency to ignore time a little bit as we talk. In our first session, I want you to just kind of get an overview of Appalachian values and culture. And there's a handout book there that has a copy of the slides in it and some slides that we will not look at today. But in that book, it give you room also to take notes if you'd like to do that. Why do we need to study different culture groups and to begin to understand them? Well, part of that is because as you go into any culture group within America or in a foreign country or an international country, you're going in and beginning the process of plowing the soil and planting the seed. When I grew up in the mountains in the head of a hollow, and you'll hear me call that hollow, that's a valley between two mountains, and the mountains are very sharp. You probably hear me calling it a holler today. It's the same thing. It's hollow for city folk and holler for people from the mountains. But when I grew up, we had a small farm, and my dad raised blackberries, copperheads, and we raised some other things. But there was a lot of critters around. But this time of the year was a time when we began to turn the soil and begin to get things ready for planting of seed. As a matter of fact, by this time, we'd already put the potatoes in the ground, the kennebecs, and we're getting ready to do some other tilling of the soil. There has to be the tilling of the soil, but you have to understand the soil. When I went to plant sweet potato drills, I did a different type of soil preparation than what I did when I went to plant Irish potatoes. When I got ready to put out the tomatoes, I did a different preparation of the soil than what I did when I put out corn and green beans. As you're planting the seed of the Word of God, the Scriptures teach us to be cautious of where we are. Paul says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. We plow the soil, we plant the seed, we cultivate the soil, we water the seed, but it's God who gives the growth in the end. And so we come back and we want to know how we can do that effectively as we plant seed. I found it interesting that when I began to study culture, now I'm a product of Appalachia, as I mentioned earlier. I spent most of my pastoring in North Georgia in the mountains of southern Appalachia, and there's not a whole lot of difference in pastoring in North Georgia than in pastoring in other parts of Appalachia. But as I pastored there in the mountains, I really didn't realize that God was uniquely preparing me for what I do today because I was pastoring southern Appalachia people. But as I opened up the Scriptures to study culture, as I made the transition from pastoring to be with the North American Mission Board, I discovered that when Jesus got ready to call his disciples, with the exception maybe of Judas, and that's debatable, he chose his disciples from Galilee. Peter Wagner says that the best way to describe a Galilean in today's terms is he's a good old boy from the coal fields of West Virginia. His dialect is different. His diet is different. When I pastored in Fort Benning, I just felt led of the Lord. I was in a new church start there, planting a church, Humber Grove Baptist Church, and I just felt led of the Lord to run an ad out on the post that said, Native West Virginian pastor, Humber Grove Baptist Church. So we put my picture in there and ran an ad, and suddenly we discovered that we had struck a gold mine. Now, when you pastor a military town, the good news is that military people come into your church ready to go to work. First Sunday, they're ready. Second Sunday, they're tithing, teaching Sunday school. If they are good members, the bad news is they leave in 6 months. If they're troublemakers, the good news is they leave in 6 months. So we had this constant flow. So I started running the ad because we had all of these West Virginians and Eastern Kentuckians and East Tennessee folk showing up at church because they wanted to go hear a preacher who could understand them when they talked. When we sat around, we talked about pop. We didn't talk about Cokes and Colas. That's Georgia language. We talked about a pop. We talked about Pokes. We talked about pinto beans. We talked about fried potatoes. We didn't talk about those diced things you get down at Bob Evans. They call fried potatoes. We talked about those things that you slice thin and you fried deep grease that help your cholesterol to get up where the doctor can find it. That's the kind we talked about, you know. And I can remember when one came in one night to, we had a Appalachian supper at our church. It was pinto beans, fried potatoes, cornbread, and buttermilk. And we had all these folk from Georgia that came, and they loved it. But one of the men had a pot of beans there, and he said, I hope you didn't get offended by the beans tonight, preacher. I said, they were good. Why? He said, well, I noticed you eat several bowls. But he said, I tried to make them like Mom made them back home. And said, I soaked them in whiskey instead of water. They were good beans. Well, that's Appalachia. When Jesus called his disciples, he called those among whom he had grown up, but he also called his disciples from a core group that could relate to one another as they began to walk with him in ministry. And the Scriptures identify that. In Matthew 26, they challenge Peter, you have that accent. On the day of Pentecost, you talk like Galileans. So we talk about Appalachian culture. You're not in Kansas anymore. You're not in Louisville anymore. It's a different world. Talk to a brother who's here today who come here from Nashville. You're not Nashville. That's not Appalachia. That's just where we go to make money, but that's not Appalachia. So it is a difference. Our culture group identifies us, and Appalachia culture is a distinct culture group, as we will look at a little bit later today. Some of us come with some preconceived notions about this culture group that's called Appalachians. Where did the notions come from that we have about Appalachia? For example, every year I'll get a call or two from a pastor who means well. They do not call trying to insult me, but they'll call me up on the telephone and they'll say, "Brother Barker, we want to come and do volunteer missions in Appalachia, and we want to go to that people that are so primitive." And I'll talk to them a little bit. It's a people group that still talk, when they talk, it sounds like dogs barking. And I can thank one of our state WMU directors for helping keep that alive. She put out a DVD about 5 years ago that had that in there. And we want to go, you know, where the men wear bib overalls, the women are pregnant, got on feed sack direct. Yeah, that's kind of what we want. And if they're from Arkansas, I send them to North Arkansas. But I'm kidding there. But I say that don't exist. Well, where did that image come from? Well, first of all, it comes from media. Back in the late 1800s, this image was developed by newspapers in New York for the purpose of selling newspapers. It made fascinating reading. The Irish in New York could read about their Irish relatives down in the mountains that they hadn't seen for several generations. The Germans in New York could read about their German friends that they hadn't seen since they came to America. It made good reading, and so it was embellished and it grew. The second way that it grew was through government. And the government took the image that had been created by the church and by media, perpetrated that, especially during the 40s and 50s, and then it kicked into high gear in the 60s when a president named Lyndon B. Johnson wanted to sell a social program. And so he created this image of these poor, half-starved, illiterate, kind of dumb people in the mountains that need our government to just come in and give them all kind of money and change their way of life for them. And so government has helped to do that. Interesting enough, it's also been created by missionary societies. Over in the Shenandoah Valley, running between West Virginia and Virginia, coming down out of Maryland, there was a group of missionaries serving at the turn of the 20th century. And as with most societal-type missions, once the missionary is on the field, the people back home tend to start forgetting about the missionary that's on the field. And so the missionaries were struggling to raise money. And they created this image of a West Virginian that had the bib overhaul, smoked a pipe, was barefooted, had the gun by his side, had the pregnant wife in the feed sack dress who was barefooted and her hair was stringy. And they created that image. They also created the image of the people that were so primitive that when they talked, it sounded like dogs barking. And they began to write about that. And they began to put that image out to raise money. And it worked. It worked. And it still works. It was an image that is an inaccurate image. It's been used in West Virginia, Kentucky. It's been used in Tennessee. It's been used in the mountains of North Carolina. It's been used in the mountains of North Georgia. And it's an image that we have today. And it was also picked up through such things as the Beverly Hillbillies and Little Abner and others along the way through cartoons. What are the various views that we have today? We have the popular national image that's out there that says just what I've just told you. The people in Appalachia are just kind of backward and wayward. We have the government's image that's not much different, except they're always standing there with their hands out wanting more tax dollars. And there's an element of truth to that. We're very independent. There are several counties in Appalachia that have voted to secede themselves from the United States from time to time. McDowell County, West Virginia is one of those. They have just decided they didn't want to be Americans any longer. And I think someone told me recently McDowell County finally voted to come back into the Union after the Civil War. They're still fighting it down there. There's industry's image. Industry loves to hire people from Appalachia still today because of their work ethic, those who are leaving the mountains. During the boom of the steel and the automobile industry, the tire industry, as West Virginians, Kentuckians, East Tennesseans moved north into Ohio and into Michigan, they could go in and get a job almost overnight because of the fact of their work ethic. As we move south today, we find that employment is easy. I first moved south to start pastoring. I was a bivocational pastor by choice for a number of years. It was in Dalton, Georgia, during the days of what we call day labor. And you could go in and get a job, work today, get paid tonight. We had a number of people from West Virginia, Kentucky, who came in to work day labor. It was interesting. The textile mills quickly moved them into permanent employment, even giving them advances because of work ethic. They wanted those type of individuals. There's the church's image. Dorothy McCauley says in her article on Southern Baptists in Appalachia that as Southern Baptists, we're intrigued by Appalachia and we go there hoping to make a difference, and we see ourselves as we used to be and we turn and flee. And there's an element of strong truth in that. After pastoring in Georgia for most of my ministry, moving back to West Virginia, I think 7 years ago, I would have had to have done some serious heart searching to have pastored in the mountains of West Virginia again. They're strong lay-led churches. I go to some of our churches, and Mike Watson is a missionary in the northern part of West Virginia, and he has this experience in his area where you go in and the deacon has his time up front, and then the music director or the chorister has their time, and then the chairman of the deacons has his time for prayer. And if he likes the preacher, they have a short prayer time. If he don't like the preacher, they'll go for 15, 20 minutes pray. Then the preacher has his time. And a service, none of it is joined together. Sometimes the Holy Spirit will get in and weave it together. Most of the time, it's just four different shows, all for the same $20 bill. So you know how that goes. I was in a church during a revival, and the pastor leaned over and whispered to me, "I've not told them you're preaching today." I thought, ooh. So the guy got up and started the service, made all the announcements, and he took about 10 minutes to make 3 minutes worth of announcements and prayer. Then the guy got up and took care of the music, and by the time he got through, it was 20 minutes to 12. Then the chairman of the deacons got up, and he went to 10 to 12, and while he was praying, I leaned over and punched the pastor, and I said, "You're not doing so well here, are you?" He said, "How'd you know?" I said, "Because they're eating up your time." He said, "Well, I just didn't let them know you were coming today." And then he got up and said, "We have a guest preacher today, our missionary." And the face on those men fell. Afterwards, I spoke to them and said, "Everything's all right. I usually preach as long as you all take in preliminary, so it's no problem." And I did, by the way. So, but, you know, I don't know that I could have handled that 7 years ago coming back into that. That's a different world. I'm working right now with a young man from North Carolina who thought he understood Appalachian culture, and he's now pastored four churches in Appalachia, been fired from all four of them. So he's decided to be a church planter. He won't make it there either. But he said to me on the phone this week, he said, "Bill," he said, "they don't understand what church is." And I said to him, "You don't understand how to lead them to what church is." My first Southern Baptist pastor was Mount Pisgah in Chatsworth. It was that away, Chatsworth, Georgia. I spent 2 years introducing them to a church bulletin. 2 years. I spent 4 years, never preached a sermon against Santa Claus, never said anything negative. But when I went there, the Sunday before Christmas, the preacher didn't preach. Santa Claus came to church. Now, that to me is idolatry. Now, I could have went in there and ripped out that idol and been the former pastor, and they would have kept Santa Claus. But I started introducing them to Advent. And at the end of the fourth year, the deacons had a special call meeting and voted not to have Santa Claus on Sunday anymore. And that's continued to this day. You've got to step into their world and walk with them. And when you do that, you can make change. So what's the church's image? And you may come at it with some religious idea or some spiritual idea of what Appalachia is. They're just people like the rest of us, like any culture group. But we have to come in and walk with them where they are. Then we have our own self-image. And if you're from Appalachia, you'll know that we don't see ourselves as people see us from the outside. How many of you are come from Appalachia? Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia? Okay, you're from over in that part of the world, yeah. So we see ourselves a little different than what others see us. Why do we study it? WVU, West Virginia University, did a study a few years ago. I was doing this in one meeting like this, talking about culture, and had a guy in there, and he looked up and he said, the WMU did that study. I said, no, the WVU. But they used, working with the county extension agents, they did an interesting study. They placed a number of agents out in the field, and they gave half of them training to help them be culturally sensitive to where they were going, and the other half they did not give training. In the group they did not give training, they placed native West Virginians. At the end of the two-year study, they found that those who were sensitive to the culture, and one of the interesting ones they pointed out was an agent from New Jersey. Now, folks, when a New Jerseyan can come to the coalfields of West Virginia and survive, that's a modern-day miracle. But they found he outperformed the native West Virginian who did not have cultural training. As we look at culture groups, whether you're going to Appalachia, you're going to the Midwest, you're going to New England, you're going to Canada, or you're going to go to Western Kentucky, you need to understand where you are. And in part, what I'm going to share with you today is principles that will guide you regardless of where you go in the world. You need to understand the culture group where you're going. What is Appalachia? It's a mountain range that starts down in Mississippi. And for purposes of the Appalachian Regional Commission, it goes up through New York, and it includes three subdivisions. And this is kind of the region. It is 42% rural. The population of it basically is small town rural population. And as you look across this region, it covers 13 states, and it's identified as a culture group for purposes of government grants and government loans. When we look at the mountain range, that is different. The mountain range starts in Mississippi and goes all the way up into Canada. It covers the New England area, moves all the way up into New Brunswick, Canada. And the mountain range is a range that's been identified that is made up of a number of sub-mountain ranges. As your missionary, I serve in partnership with 11 state conventions, and I serve 10 of those states. And I work in volunteer mobilization, and I work with church planters, I work with pastors in church strengthening, I work with ministry centers, and I work with those at Appalachia who relate to Southern Baptist life. I work trying to reach 13 million unchurched people, and you're going to hear that again and again today. 5% of the lostness of America lives in Appalachia. I work in an area such as Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that has more unchurched persons in that area than we have in the entire state of Kentucky, that we have in the entire state of South Carolina. And if you ask me if I'm passionate about getting people to move into Pennsylvania to help us plant churches, you betcha I am. And I think God is calling people that are just not listening, so we want to reach you. I also work in areas that we have over 90% unchurched in those areas. Some of those are here in eastern Kentucky. You don't have to go far. Some of those are in West Virginia. If I take you to McDowell County, West Virginia, it's roughly 90% unchurched. And many of those who are churched believe that they're saved by taking of the sacraments, or they're saved because they do good things. They're not saved by grace through faith. If you go to Julo, they're saved because they handle snakes, and so we can take you there if you want to go. How did this region get formed? During the colonial era of America, it was claimed by Europeans, and as Virginia began to fill up, the Europeans began to move west, driving out the Indians or mingling with the Indians and trying to make a way of life. If you find anyone who's been in Appalachia and their family roots go back into the pre-Civil War days, you will probably find that we have some Native American in us. I'm 12.5% Cherokee, for example. My bloodline is basically Scotch, Irish, German, Cherokee, and only God knows what else. But you will find a mixture of different bloods there. A great deal of the Civil War was fought in Appalachia, from Pennsylvania down to North Georgia. It was a bloody battle. And if you go into parts of Appalachia, they're still fighting the battle today. When I went into East Tennessee to pastor a number of years ago, it was a new church start, and I was the second guy in there. The first one had left it, had eight people, moved back to Pennsylvania, and I went in as a 19-year-old student and in school in Chattanooga to go there and serve as a church planter pastor. And I can still recall my first day on the field, Mother's Day, 1971, and a guy across the street called me, and he said, son, come over here. And I walked over. And incidentally, this was my first real exposure to Southern Baptist. This was an independent Baptist church. And the guy said, I'm a deacon down here at First Baptist Church. My name's Oscar. I got one question for you. Where was you born and raised? And I said, I was born and raised in West Virginia. He said, north or south of the Mason-Dixon line. I said, down the coal fields. He said, son, you'll make it here. Every time we turn around, they're sending one of those, and he named the kind of Yankee he was talking about, in here to serve. And that Baptist deacon worked with me, and 6 months later, we were running 128 to 130 every Sunday. And he said, work with me, and I'll show you how to grow a church. And he did. Great, great man. Love the Lord. He just didn't want no Yankees in there. They still fight in the war. If I take you to Harlan County, Kentucky, that county's still divided, been divided since the war. And we're fighting some battles down there today, and trying to reach people with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we reach them on the wrong end of the county. We make the other end mad, and they're Southern Baptists. And they're going to be in heaven, I hope, together. But they just that's just kind of the mindset. And then the area was settled by veterans and immigrants and adventurers. I'll give you a couple words there. One is, as this area was settled, the United States government at the end of the American Revolutionary War gave land in Kentucky, West Virginia, what's now West Virginia, to veterans because they couldn't pay them. So they just gave them the land. And then when the coal mines and the timber business, the steel business was going, the men who owned that would go to Ellis Island. And as immigrants got off of the boats, and came through the processing there with immigration. As they came out in this process, they would meet them there, and they would say to them, we got a job for you. And they just herd them on to train cars, and they'd haul them, for example, down the coal fields of West Virginia and Kentucky. And they would, you go into a coal camp, and you would have one end of it made up of Italians, and the other end made up of Irish, and in the middle would be the Germans, and they couldn't understand one another. And they would go under the mountain and mine coal, but they couldn't speak one another's language. And out of this began to be this bringing together of culture so that as you travel across the mountain ranges, you will find where Mike serves up northern West Virginia, strong Italian flavor. If you move over into the eastern side of West Virginia, strong German architect. Strong German flavor. If you move into where I'm from in the coal fields, strong Scotch-Irish, some Italian influence down through there. And I can still remember growing up, and we had a gentleman on our creek who was Italian, and there were no Catholic churches on our creek, but he would catch the bus to Charleston to go to the Catholic church. He was an Italian. And he still did things like they did him in the old country, and he still spoke the language. He was a proud Italian. He would not give it up. That kind of formed that region. And I was reading an article the other day by an Irishman who said that, and he's now gone on, but in writing about being moved into the coalfields of Appalachia, he said that he left the poverty and bondage of Ireland to move into a worse poverty and a worse bondage. When he moved into the coalfields, the problem was he could not escape from it. Because when you came into the coalfields in those days, the company owned your soul. They owned you. They controlled you. And that has only been broken in recent times. So that's a little bit of the early history. As we look across the region, the geography of the area makes it difficult to do much except to timber. If you go into the mountains of eastern Kentucky, there used to be a lot of little spot gardens, but you can't put out a garden that's large enough to be profitable. The local economy cannot support most of Appalachia. As you'll see later today, I deal a lot with poverty, and there's a lot of poverty. If you're coming there to serve, you will notice that. We specialize in tourism, but tourism, with few exceptions, Gatlinburg and the Pigeon Forge area being one, but few exceptions, tourism will not offset the deficit in the economy. And where we do a lot of work, we still find that a lot of tourism, there's a lot of poverty. The region is basically a blue-collar region, and if you're going to come into this area to pastor, you also need to understand that, because as you come into pastor in this area, when you work with blue-collar people, particularly those who have the union mindset, you got to understand them. When you come into the union mindset, blue-collar worker church, and you say to them, I'm your pastor, I'm in charge, what you've just said to them is, I'm the boss, and your job is to undermine and fight me on everything I do. I was talking to one pastor who came in to pastor in the coalfields, and he was in trouble, and he had given me his resume and said, get me out of here. And I said to him, what happened? He said, well, the first Sunday I was here, I told him I was in charge. I said, what you told him your first Sunday there was, everything I do hereafter, you're to undermine and destroy. And that's what happened. You've got to go into those churches with the mindset that God is a company and they are the union and you're the shop stewards. And you represent the company to the union and the union to the company. And you say, that's not biblical. I think it is. It's called shepherding. You got a flock and you're to shepherd them and you're to lead them. And you can lead them in time, but you got to remember, they've been feeding on some of this grass that's given them no nourishment for years, and they're malnourished spiritually. And if you start feeding them something besides just grass with no nourishment, you start moving them over to something that's going to give them nourishment, you're going to have some problems. They're going to get sick on you. And they get sick, they get mad. When they get mad, you find them in the church. It's just that simple. So you walk in. You have to understand the area where you're going to be. Quickly, I want to walk through the regions. I don't want to linger here. There are three regions that have been identified, and all three are distinctive regions, and these are identified by the Appalachian Regional Commission. And as you look at those regions are also divided up. And if I could walk over here for a moment, this area here, this is the Mason-Dixon line. And if you have pastored or worked north of the Mason-Dixon line, it's different from serving south of the Mason-Dixon line. It's two different, distinct worlds. If you divide up Appalachia, you will find that there are those sociologists who study the region that is broken up into basically nine different subgroups. And the area most of us think of is the central region. We think of Appalachia. When you go into the central region of Appalachia, that's West Virginia, southern West Virginia, extreme southeastern Kentucky, southwestern Virginia over Lee Scott and Wise County, picking up on a little bit of Buckhannon, then dropping over into East Tennessee, you step into a culture that is like it used to be back in the 30s. I go back into the coal fields and go down into West Virginia, go over to eastern Kentucky. If I'm down McDowell County, Wyoming County, West Virginia, Logan, or I move over into Jenkins, Kentucky, down that area, Lookout, Hillard. If I go over into some of the communities in southwestern Virginia, like St. Charles, folks, I step back in time. They have not progressed, they have regressed in many, many different ways. So as I talk about the culture today, please understand, I'm giving you a general overview. If you want to talk about a specific region, we can talk about that. What identifies these regions? The central region, the northern region, basically, I skipped through that one, is identified. It's identified by steel and agriculture. It's identified today because of agriculture and education. The central region, in this area, it has some of the most grinding poverty in America today. It's where the war on poverty was started. And when I go into McDowell County, West Virginia, or I go over to St. Charles, Virginia, I take you into some areas where they're going to be in third world conditions. We still have people who live in houses with dirt floors. Matter of fact, this past year in eastern Kentucky, we rebuilt two homes completely for widows who were living in houses with dirt floors. We still have a number of outhouses, I understand, from I believe it's Berea College, and one out of five, and that part still have outdoor plumbing. And so we wrestle with that in that area. You wrestle with the entitlement mentality, you owe me. And folks, that's generational. Let's suppose you want to go to the coal fields of Kentucky or West Virginia to pasture. You better have some outside income, because they don't believe in paying a preacher, you owe them. American Baptists in 1907 made a decision not to intentionally plant churches in the coal fields of West Virginia because the people there did not believe in paying a preacher. That hasn't changed. They don't believe in paying a preacher, and they don't believe in missions, but they sure do love the volunteers that come in to serve. So it's a mindset that's generational, and you will not change that overnight. My mother and dad, when I was a bivocational pastor in North Georgia, they used to say to me, Billy, you need to be full-time. And their idea of full-time was below poverty wages. And they just couldn't quite grasp why I had to buy groceries and feed a family and that type of thing. When you get into the southern region, you're going to be in Virginia, the Tennessees, the Carolinas, North Georgia, the heart of the Foxfire books. And a lot of tradition is there. Appalachia is the same, and yet it's different. When I was pastored in North Georgia, the way that a pastor was treated is different from the way a pastor is treated in Central Appalachia. Different from the way a pastor is treated in Northern Appalachia, Pennsylvania. In the southern part of Appalachia, planting churches, and some of you are going to be looking at planting churches. Planting churches was not as challenging. I've planted a couple of churches in the southern part. Helped start two more as a pastor. I went into a church that was a very sick and troubled church, and it had three distinct congregations, and I helped two of them start new churches. One of them failed, thank God. The other one's still going. The one that failed become Pentecostal. That's where they need to be in the beginning. But it's challenging anywhere. But it's you can start a church in the South and get it up and flourishing if you've got any work ethic about you at all, and God's hands upon you. You move into the coal fields of Appalachia. Let me just illustrate it this way. We had a representative from the North American Mission Board interviewing some people who were serving in Appalachia and had been there as North American Mission Board missionaries for several years. One of those is a young man by the name of Mike York. Mike York looked at the North American Mission Board representative when that representative said to him, how is your work doing? He said, sir, I serve in Logan, West Virginia. In Logan, West Virginia, you have to be there 5 years before they will let you say hello on Main Street. I can now say the first syllable. I've been there 2.5. He was a very frustrated young man, because they were saying, you've got to plant a church in 2-3 years. And he was in an area where after 2.5 years, he was still trying to get his feet on the ground and figure out where he was walking. You go to northern Appalachia, we're watching some very successful church plants, but you don't go out and advertise that you're a Southern Baptist. If you do, you're treated as a cult. I was with one of our church planters up in Meadville, and spent the night in the Holiday Inn Express. The next day I'm sitting there eating breakfast. And by the way, I'm a good church planner because I stayed at Holiday Inn Expresses. But I was sitting there the next day, and the lady came over to me, and she said she saw my shirt, had Appalachian Regional Ministry on it, and she said, what is that? And I told her, and she said, who are you with? And I said, Southern Baptist. She said, never heard of them. I said, well, let's sit down, let's talk. There's nobody else in here. And she got a cup of coffee and sat down, and I was going to witness to her. She said, oh, I'm a Christian. I said, do you know a fellow named Mike Dobson? I said, yes. Yeah. Well, that's my pastor. He led me to Jesus. I said, oh, how wonderful. Mike is one of our church planners, and she's a very active member of the church. It says it on the sign, right out front, right at the bottom. It says affiliated with Southern Baptist Convention. It is a number six font, but it's there. So when you come into the region, that's a little bit about it. I'll close with this one. In the northern, what are the influences that are going to impact us? Labor unions, decline, that's going to have a big impact upon it. Education in the north, they put a great deal of pride in education. Pittsburgh and the surrounding area has 43 colleges and universities. That's a lot of universities, major universities in that area. Central region, there's a lot of people leaving there, 7 to 8 million. Some estimate the impact has been over 20 million have left the central region of Appalachia when you take the children that have went with those who left. Labor union, strong. There are some things I don't discuss in Appalachia. One of them is labor unions. The other one is politics. They don't know if I'm a Democrat or Republican or an independent, and I don't want them to know. I don't want them to know. I was in one of our churches and had a layman say, if another Southern Baptist comes in here and tells me to vote Republican, I'm leaving the convention and so is the church because I'm the head knocker around here. And he meant it. He said, I just don't want to hear politics. I'm a Democrat. I was born a Democrat. I'll die a Democrat. I said, brother. He said, what are you? I said, I haven't figured it out yet. I just leave it at that. Labor unions, boy, don't say nothing negative about them. You can go down Georgia and talk against them all you want, but if you go to West Virginia and say something against them, they may not see you anymore. My dad, I can go home. If I were to get his blood pressure up, I'd just say something negative about the labor union right before I leave. It takes him 6 months to recover from it. Oh, he gets bent out of shape. Unemployment, poverty, the coal industry, the steel industry, the timber industry. The South has been changed. TVA rearranged the South, made a very positive, had a very positive influence upon the South. The textile industry both defined the South and is now redefining the South as the textile jobs are moving to China, India, Mexico. It's redefining the South. So as you start to look at the region, you're going to see some things of interest here as we work across the region. Let's stop and take a break, and we'll come back together in about 10 minutes and just give you a chance. Any instructions?